I'm going to try and condense three class periods into one today, because I would like to take you out into the woods. And tomorrow looks like that might be a good time to do that.
So we take all pieces of bread to drop, so we
won't. Depends on how much faith you have in me. So we're going to kind of whiz by a few of the subjects today that normally I would spend more time amplifying, because I want to give you a little bit of background material and a handout on some of the major tree species and some information like that, so when we go for our little tour of the forest tomorrow, you'll have a little bit of background and you might be able to identify at least the majority of the tree species as we go along. We're fortunate here in Holden that there's quite a variety of things that are immediately accessible to us. We're going to have to focus on trees because we're too early in the year this year to see much on the flowering plants. Ruth has already shown you about the only thing that's in flower. There's a Calypso and a Trillium, and I think everything else is still in the boot stage. And the boot stage means it's just starting to grow. You saw glacier lilies? Yeah, glacier lilies. They grow right out of the snowbank. So there's relatively small amount of the plants, you know, the smilocyanins and things like that are not in flower yet, at least on the trail that I walked last night. So we're going to hit glaciation very quickly, we're going to hit climate very quickly, and then I'm going to take you into plant communities and work on that. So if it gets overwhelming, or if it gets terribly boring, try to snore quietly so as to not disturb me. Or just holler. And as I said before, you know, questions, just raise your hand and belt it out. And I'll try to answer you. And as I said yesterday, it may be, I don't know. And there's a lot of things I don't know. In fact, the more I learn about vegetation patterns here in the eastern slopes of the Washington Cascades, the more I realize how little we really know about the systems and how they operate. And when we think we know what's going on, it's only because we're deluding ourselves, because it's infinitely more complex and interrelated than we even imagine. So we're going to get into a little bit on I touched yesterday a little bit on some of the glaciation. And if you look out the windows up here at the mountains above you and the valley that you're in a classic, if we had the opportunity of walking up the valley, we're in a classic U-shaped glaciated valley characteristic of alpine glaciation. When the alpine glacier is one that originates on the mountain face and cuts down, and it tends to cut a very U-shaped channel and goes down. And if you're in Lake Chelan, you're looking at a glacial trough that's filled with water. The fjords of Norway are nothing but glacially carved things that have been flooded by the sea, or in some cases here, like Lake Chelan, it is fresh water that fills that. These are characteristic of the very sharp-edged mountains that are characteristic of alpine glaciation, because you have the glacier eating away at the slopes, plucking, freezing and thawing and plucking away the rock and scraping it out, and you get very sharp, angular arêtes and cols and things like that. Climbers can talk about those. And people that climb, or there's something wrong with them. I have some friends that are, and that's true. There is something wrong with them. They're crazy. Anybody that wants to go stand on top of a precipice, you know, is something that I don't understand at all.
I learned about a month ago why it is that climbers are roped together. And it's to keep the same ones from leaving and going home.
Okay. who might argue with that, you know? That's just a very, very brief overview of that. There's erosional landforms, there's depositional landforms, there's all kinds of things you can get into in glaciology. Those of you from Minnesota, you're dealing in a continentally glaciated landscape. everything you have there is a function of the glaciation that has taken place. But one of the things you need to understand about climatic patterns and about things in the mountains is our relationship. Not quite all going to fit. Let's start here. A great deal of the energy that we get from the sun on the surface of the earth is directly related to how far north and south we are in regards to the tropics. Now, the Tropic of Capricorn and the Tropic of Cancer are those lines, imaginary lines around the earth's surface, that the sun, as the earth journeys through the heavens, it tilts back and forth. Is either the sun is either directly overhead or at an angle to that. Over the tropics, the sun is almost always at nearly 90 degree angles to the surface of the earth. And so the light is quite concentrated. A given block of light is quite concentrated and you have a lot of energy. Has anybody ever taken a magnifying glass out and burned a hole in paper? Or have you been a little kid and gone out and killed ants on the sidewalk like I did, you know, zapping with that? The energy in a square yard or so of full sunlight is absolutely mind-boggling. You can take something like a 36-inch mirror and melt steel bars with it. And so the amount of energy per unit area is an important characteristic. Well, the vertical rays of the sun down near the tropics are concentrated into a fairly small area. But because of the angle and the slope of the earth, you know, the earth is round. And did you know that if you took the earth and reduced it to the size of a ball bearing, that it would be the most perfectly round and formed ball bearing that's ever been made? So for its size, though we as very small individuals relative to the size of the earth, the mountains there look huge, you know, and very imposing. On a proper scale, if it was reduced to a ball bearing, it would be better than anything we've made so far in the ball bearing industry, you know, if it was reduced to that scale. So it's very symmetrical.
I've heard similar comparison between the earth. If you reduced it to the size of a bowling ball, it would be rounder and smoother.
Oh yes, yeah, much more so. And so your scale, our human size scale, plays a great deal to do with what we look at, you know. But the sun's rays coming at the northern and the southern latitudes as the earth's surface curves away, you have the same amount of energy spread over a much wider area. It's much more diffuse, and so you get a smaller amount per square foot on the ground, and so your temperatures tend to be lower. And this has a great deal to do with major long-term climatic patterns, the major circulation systems in the Earth's atmosphere, the formation of subtropical high-pressure systems, which profoundly affect the climate over large areas of the Earth, and the movement of those. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we have what's known as a West Coast marine climate, meaning that it is strongly modified by the fact we've got the Pacific Ocean offshore, and an oceanic climate is at once both cooler and more moist than a non-oceanic climate. It is cooler in the summertime and warmer in the winter because water's relative heat, it holds more heat and releases it more slowly than does land. And when people talk about continental climates, they're talking about climates that in the summer under the direct rays of the sun heat up quite rapidly, you know, but in the winter when there is not much energy available, they cool down much more rapidly. And I had a professor of climatology at Brigham Young University who was from New Zealand, Dr. Gray, and he had studied at the University of Wisconsin to get his PhD. And he stoutly averred in class that it had the worst climate in the world. He says, miserably hot and humid in the summer and wretchedly cold in the wintertime. You know, he had absolutely nothing good to say about it, kind of thing. And but here we have this West Coast marine climate, but it's characterized and modified here in the Pacific Northwest by the fact that we have a summer period with relatively low amounts of precipitation, most commonly. And this is because of the movement of what's known as a subtropical high-pressure system north during the summertime and we get this extended dry period in the Pacific Northwest, that climatic pattern profoundly alters the vegetation that we have and how it grows. In the Midwest and even in Utah and places like that, most grasses and herbs, even though you may be dealing with a relatively dry climate, such as Utah where I came from, are active in the summer months because a large proportion of their precipitation comes in the summer. Our grasses out in the shrub steppes here of eastern Washington and Oregon are active in the fall and the spring, and they go dormant in the middle of the summer. And they're called cool season grasses because a majority of our precipitation comes in the winter months, and we have extended times in the summer without precipitation. Most other places under a more continental climate get a reasonable proportion of their total annual precipitation budget scattered through the growing season. And so the phenology, in other words, the timing and growth patterns of the plants, varies a great deal. So here in the Pacific Northwest, we have vegetation that is adapted to our climatic pattern. And our climatic pattern is profoundly altered in this state by the mountains that we talked about yesterday. And I needed you to understand a little bit of those great mountain passes and masses and the influence that takes place. One of the striking characteristics of the Cascades Mountains is the vegetation on the west slopes is very much different than the vegetation on the east slopes. And particularly the further east you go from the mountains, the greater change it is. The west slopes are traditionally blanketed in very heavy forest, except where we've been active logging. Large trees, the largest trees in the world from the standpoint of total stand biomass of the thing. Now, as individuals, you're still dealing with some of the California, the giant sequoias. But as far as overall size and productivity of the forest, the Pacific Northwest forests have been studied, have been found to have the largest total biomass of any forest known in the world. And part of that is due to our climatic pattern of abundant precipitation. It is an area that is dominated by conifer vegetation because much of the west side, a considerable proportion of the annual growth of trees from the standpoint of them accumulating energy and resources takes place in the winter months, particularly along the coast. And so this gives conifers a competitive advantage over broadleaves. You ever wonder how come it's mainly broadleaf forests in the east and conifer forests here in this part of the west? That's one of the reasons, because of the climatic pattern that we have here in the western United States. There's a significant advantage to maintaining your leaves and doing photosynthesis during the winter months. And so they gain a competitive advantage over the broadleaves. And we have in the Pacific Northwest a relatively small proportion of our forests is made up of broadleaf species. But the total productivity of these very rich forests on the west slope of the Cascades, their biomass accumulations have not been matched in, as so far as studies go, anywhere else in the world. In part because the forests tend to be very long-lived and this biomass accumulates through time. And one of the reasons they are very long-lived is we do not often get major events of catastrophic winds, such as Hurricane Hugo or something like that, coming through, you know, and literally knocking the forest down. And the Pacific Northwest is relatively sheltered from those, though on occasion we do have some pretty severe winds. A Columbus Day storm of 1968 or something.
Well, you comment on the apparent aberration of the larch, which is coniferous but also deciduous.
We're going to talk about that one. One of my favorite trees.
62.
Was it 62? Okay. I wasn't in the Pacific Northwest at the time. I saw some of the ramifications when I first arrived at Oregon State in 1970. They still took us out and showed us some. And we still have occasional big blowdowns like that, but nothing like a Hurricane Hugo that rolls through every 100 years or something like that. So, in this mountain, recognizing it here in the Pacific Northwest, the climatic pattern is such that winds move from west to east across the northern hemisphere. And so what takes place on the Pacific coast eventually ends up over on the Atlantic coast. those of you that are downwind get the benefit of everything that we produce, whether that be for good or for ill, you know, and generally it's for ill. Some of the purest air yet sampled in the United States is up on the Pusaten Wilderness. It's not that far from coming across the ocean, and they have some of the clearest air is up in a place called Slate Peak that so far the EPA has tested. As you go further and further east, there's a lot that accumulates, and the air becomes less clear and more polluted.
Where is Slate Peak?
Slate Peak, where Hart's Pass is. You know where Winthrop is? Mm-hmm. West of Winthrop and then up in the mountains.
There are a lot of fossils there.
Yeah, that's part of the Metau Formation. And there's a lot of, I think my kids go over there every fifth grade. One of the fifth grade teachers takes them over there and they collect fossils. And they always borrow my rock hammer. That's the big issue, they get to borrow the rock hammer. As these winds move from west to east, we talked a little bit yesterday, the air as it approaches the mountains is forced to rise. And as air is forced to rise, it cools. And as air cools, its capacity to hold moisture is decreased. Warm air will hold a greater proportion of moisture than will cold air. As it cools, it starts to rain and it comes out as precipitation. And so you get an intense amount of precipitation, or a lot of precipitation, on the side of the mountain that is exposed to the prevailing winds. One of the reasons that Australia is a relatively dry landmass is that it doesn't have very high mountains, and there's nothing to cause this cooling of the atmosphere as the air masses move across the continent and cause a deposition of moisture. So that's one of the reasons they have such a dry climate. But as that air mass goes over the top of the mountains and starts to descend, the air warms, its capacity to hold moisture is again increased. Warm air works better than cold air. Have you ever tried drying your hair with a cold air dryer? It takes a lot longer than if it's warm, you know, kind of thing. There's reasons for why we do these things. But as that air comes down, it literally, in many cases, sucks moisture out of the forest, because a tree is nothing more than a great pump that pumps water and some nutrients out of the ground and up into the air. And it's referred to regularly as evapotranspiration, in other words, evaporation and transpiration, the breathing, so to speak, of plants takes place with a great deal of use of water. And some plants are much better adapted to conservation of water than others, and so it goes with our conifer tree species. So your forests change in character as you go from the west slope to the east slope. They become relatively less productive from the standpoint of total amounts of biomass. They become relatively less dense. The trees as a group are smaller in stature because there simply are not the amount of resources available. They become biologically more diverse because there's a greater pattern on the landscape, and they become more complex in their structure and their organization. He called it alpha and beta diversity, and I can never remember. One is the variation from site to site, and the other is a variation in the amount of species you've got there. So the development of rain shadows and the movement of air masses across the country are significant modifiers of our climate, and we live in right at a transition right here at Holden. Saying we live in here at Holden, we're in a transition between the West Coast climate and much drier climate. So we can go outside of the village here and in a very short distance find most of the species found on both sides of the state, right, within a very short distance. So you've got a rich variety to look at here, so it makes it a neat area to look at. But as I said, it also, because it is such a mix, it doesn't fit well into some of our preconceived ideas of what vegetation patterns ought to be. And so I wasn't really joking a lot yesterday when I said I really don't like it because it doesn't match most of the rest of the area that I work in. And I have a hard time understanding because I haven't spent a lot of time on it. Oops, let's do it this way. If I can get this right, we'll get it right. This diagram here deals with the patterns of broad vegetation zones on the Okanagan National Forest. And I put that together. The Okanagan is a relatively dry and cool forest because, remember, it is located east of the North Cascades, where they are at once the highest and the widest, and so the air mass has been bled of more of its moisture than it has further south. As you start in the forested zone, people is ponderosa pine, and it will grow part way up the mountain. Then as you increase in elevation, precipitation increases and or the temperatures become cooler, so the total evaporation stress upon a tree is less, and so trees that are less efficient at managing their water balance can start to grow, or trees that are more adaptable to cold climate. So then you pick up PSME is Douglas fir, lodgepole pine is PICO, LAOC is larch, and that has got a very interesting geographic distribution. I hope you don't let me forget that, Carl, because it's really interesting. Engelmann spruce, subalpine fir, and these lines suggest schematically on this hypothetical mountain the approximate location of where they might be found as you go up. And then as you gain yet higher elevation, the steep southerly and westerly slopes at the highest elevations tend to have white bark pine on them, and the northerly slopes have Larix lealli or subalpine larch. Now if you look out this window at the very top of the mountain up here, there's trees that are standing up there and they look like snags right now. Those are subalpine larch, and subalpine larch will grow to a higher altitude than any other tree in the Pacific Northwest. And larches, as Carl mentioned, lose their needles. They're a conifer, but they're not an evergreen. They're deciduous, and they lose their needles. And apparently, this is an adaptation to them for snow loads and things like that, because by not having the needles on them, when you get the heavy snow and everything, they do well. They survive. And conifers and larches are always found in relatively snow, heavily snowy areas, fairly far north. That, and they're one of my very favorite trees, the two larches. They're a gracefully beautiful tree, and I really like them. But that's a general pattern. Here's sort of a block diagram where the same sort of thing, and the heavy lines are areas where, as an ecologist, we would call that tree to be climax. Now, climax means simply that species is best adapted to those conditions without disturbance to replace itself on the site. And that we're going to develop a lot more as we start talking a little bit later today about plant succession and what climax means.
Do you have a printout of that
one right there?
Transparency?
No, not that one. I didn't bring one of that. I've got some other things where I rank them according to shade tolerance and fire tolerance as part of a handout that you have. Oh yeah. Have they got a Xerox?
Yes. Yeah.
They can Xerox that one.
Enlarges.
But that's for the Okanagan. Now, I'll eventually be putting one together for the Wenatchee, and there'll be more species on it. It'll be more complex, but it'll be done for the Wenatchee. I've already done one of these. Well, that's an anecdote I won't bother telling. But these are just schematic things that give you an idea of the relationships that you might see out there on the landscape as you start going through. And it's this sort of pattern that we start seeing developing as an ecologist that's interested in vegetation classification like myself, that I start looking towards, you know, as I use them as an indicator. If I come into an area where there is Pacific silver fir, then I know that I'm in an area of very strong maritime climatic influence, that snowpacks are quite high, that there's a lot of moisture, that the soils never really dry out through the growing season because Pacific silver fir is incapable of growing under those conditions. And I also know that it's not necessarily all that frosty in closed forest conditions because Pacific silver fir is susceptible to frost. Now, it oftentimes grows in quite cold areas, but it grows underneath other trees that have pioneered that particular site, and it has its role that it plays. But it's very shade tolerant, very competitive with other species once established, and eventually it will replace all of its associated species by and large and assert itself as the climax tree because it will reproduce in its own shade. Now other species don't necessarily do that.
When I grew up, we always called the western larch tamarack.
Yeah.
Is that the common name for
it? Well, that is a, where I grew up, they called it a tamarack, and that was salt cedar growing down along the desert streams, you know. So common names, first of all, are things. Tamarack is not really the proper common name for Western larch. That's the name of another larch species further east. And what's really interesting is in part of Oregon, there's a place called Larch Mountain, and that was noble fir, and they called noble fir larch, too. So scientific names are somewhat better than common names as far as reliability, but they're not beyond fault either because they change their names all the time, too, and they can louse you up. So common names, I personally do not like common names, because I have to remember too many. And it's easier for me to remember a scientific name than it doesn't matter who I'm talking to, whether they be from Germany or Russia or you name it. They know what I'm talking about by and large, because there's far fewer number of names I need to know. But for a lot of species, I have to know a dozen or more common names. And people come to me and say, are you familiar with such and such? And I have no idea what they're talking about. Maybe a plant that I know very well, but I have no idea because I don't know what that particular common name is.
Related to that issue, I have a little personal problem relating of accepting the universally and commonly used term Douglas fir.
Yeah.
It's a Douglas tree.
It's not a fir.
It's not a fir.
In fact, as its scientific name carries that contradiction, false hemlock, right along with it. They didn't know what to do with it. It's been called a pine, you know. It's really a group by itself. It should be Douglas tree, like you say, rather than it's not a fir. And so now they talk about true firs, because Douglas fir is so common. And they also call it red fir. The loggers call it red fir. But there is a true red fir, you know, there's an appropriate common name for it. So it gets really mixed up as you start dealing with common names. So you can get really confused in that regard.
But Clint, there is one reason that I see for people using common names too, and that is that they're comfortable with them. And if somebody comes into a group and starts using a scientific name and they don't know the scientific local language, then they draw back and they're afraid to say something. Now somebody on one of the hikes yesterday was telling me about a plant that they've seen growing in rocky areas, and it's a purple lily or something like that. And I have not heard of it, but it's a common name that you were giving, and I haven't yet figured out what it might be. Yeah. And so that's a difficulty of the common names, true.
It's a difficulty of common names, but people tend to be turned off by Arctostaphylos uberursi or Pseudosugamin zzi or any of those other things. For a long time, I actually optioned, because we use a lot of computer data analysis in our species, and you see that the diagram that I had up there before from the Okanagan Guide, I wrote it in code. Took the scientific name and abbreviated it, and it was all in code. And there's a standardized list of codes, actually nationwide now, where you take the first two letters of the first scientific name and the first two of the second scientific name. So Douglas fir, which is Pseudosuga menziesii, and pseudo is PS, and you know, it starts with PS, and then menziesii is ME, so you get PISME. Well, I found out that nobody else pronounces it like I, and sometimes they drop the P and it'll be silent. One of the ecologists, noted ecologists in Montana, his name is Bob Pfister, P-F-I-S-T-E-R, and he called it SISME. I says, for obvious reasons. I call it PISME. Well, one of my assistants and I used to talk all the time in these codes, because that's what we use all the time, and we'd be over there talking about Abgirfma and Pismithma and things like that, and people go by and they go, oh man, those guys are weird, you know. Now I write most of my stuff in common names and give them a list of common names, give them a list of codes, and give them a list of scientific names, and they can use them, but there are some problems with it. Every science has its jargon. And that's one of the rites of passage to be a member of acceptable standing in that particular field, is you've got to learn the jargon. Now, if you translate most of that jargon to common, ordinary words, all of a sudden that science loses a lot of its forbidding nature, you know, and its imposing characteristics, because all of a sudden you find out they're not talking about very complex things after all. Most of this stuff is really quite simple. And so they want to hide it behind, you know, a scholarly, you know, jargon, and it's there. And you find that with most fields of science.
It's true in other fields too.
Oh, yeah.
Religion.
Yes.
Has its own jargon.
Yes, very, very much so. And every field of study develops its own jargon in a sense to show its specialness and its separateness and its an apartness from that. And the field that I'm in is absolutely no different. The soil scientists in the United States went further. They developed a whole language, unique and different than anything had been done before, you know, to describe their soils. And a guy that used to work for me had been trained in part as a soil scientist, and he got a big kick out of typic haplozerols, and I was going, eh? You know, he says, well, there's a lot of meaning in that phrase, if you understand what it means. And I says, yeah, right, you know, because I had never studied that particular part of it. An important problem that we have here in the Cascade Mountains and in the Northern Rocky Mountains is the development of frost-prone areas in various topographic situations. And this was developed specifically for a management guide to show foresters how they might render a formerly forested site to where it is incapable of growing trees again. And I keep telling them, I said, if that's your objective, we do very well at that. We can, if you want help on taking the forest and turning them into meadows, I can help you with that. We know how to do that quite well. And they said, they assured me they didn't need any more assistance in that regard. What they really wanted to find out was how they could grow trees back on there. One of the major problems that develops is frost, and that may take place because of re-radiation. In other words, if you're at high elevation, the atmosphere is relatively thin, and so the air itself will not hold much heat when the sun goes down. You know, you can get really sunburned very easily at high elevation, but when it cools off at night, or high elevation sites, you can have it very hot in the day, and you can get frost at night, any night of the year. Carl and I were just talking yesterday about being up in a place in the Pasadena Wilderness called Horseshoe Basin. You're up to around 7,000 feet, approximately between 6,000 and 7,000 feet. And he was up there in August, and he got hailed on and snowed on and run out. You know, and I was up there at the end of August. You were July, weren't you? Or were you
up?
End of July. I was up there last August, and I got hailed on and snowed on and run out. And I tell people, when you go into these mountains, you should go into them fully prepared for the worst possible condition you can imagine. I have, in two different instances, there's been a major forest fire taking place in the mountains below us. Temperatures in the valleys where they were fighting a fire exceeded 100 degrees. It was wretchedly hot. One, we were up on a place called Freeze Out Ridge, which is off Tiffany Mountain on the Okanagan National Forest. And it snowed and hailed on us and rained on us. I had on a down vest, rain gear, and was fervently wishing that I had more clothes, you know. The other one was on Table Mountain, which is, as you go over Swak Pass, off to your left as you go south, that mountain up there is Table Mountain. We're on that. There was a fire down on the lower slopes of that. We're up walking around, and it was a hot day, and about 8 or 10 of us, and they said, I said, well, you gonna take your rain gear? And they said, no. We got up there, and we got into that much hail. And I seriously wondered if we were going to get some of the people off the mountain. And the lightning was cracking over the top of our heads. You cannot ever trust Mother. And go prepared. A guy that works for me now said he was in the Northern Rocky Mountains with some people that had been accustomed to working in Alaska, and they were working at very high elevation. He says, and it snowed on us, and it was the middle of the summer. They were installing some meteorological stations up there. He says, and those two guys had to stay in a tent in their sleeping bags because they were completely unprepared. He says, even though they were experienced people, they were not aware of the changes that can take place even in the middle of the summer on our high elevation mountains. So don't go unprepared. You know, the mountaineer's list of 10 essentials is wonderful and should always be followed when we go out. So you get the re-radiation. Not only that, you'll get cold air that will drain down into low areas and make it what they call a frost pocket. And if you see certain species such as subalpine fir and Inkelmann spruce at low elevation in a valley floor, where on the side slopes you'll see dry side species or warm species such as ponderosa pine, you can rest assured that you're looking at a frost pocket down there in the valley. And this really came home to me when I was doing research on my thesis down on the Mount Hood National Forest. My major professor had told me, he says, always watch out for these frost pockets, but it never really dawned on me. And I was out in late September doing the soil profile descriptions of a lot of the plots that I had taken earlier in the year. And I had one hillside, and I just went slightly around the hillside from one aspect to another. And in one, I was just freezing to death. It was colder than a well digger's tailbone in there, you know. And I was wondering, what, you know, and when you're doing soil stuff, you dig the pit, which is a terrible thing to have to do. And it's hard work digging holes. And but then you have to take the soil and the various horizons, and you get some estimate of texture by wetting it and rubbing it between your hands, you know, and plasticity and all that kind of stuff. Well, when it's freezing and you're out there spraying water on the soil and doing that, it's not a very pleasant experience, you know. And then I went just in a few minutes, it was only a very short drive, in a few minutes around to the other thing, and it was a same elevation. You know, I had just contoured around the hill. Very warm, very pleasant on there. I got the air photos out and I could see the pattern in the vegetation. One was in a stream drainage that went up to a big basin where the cold air concentrated, and then it just flowed like water down there and concentrated. And then the other one was just on a mountain face where it just drained right off, and you could see it just like that. Once you'd experienced it. Now once I'd experienced it, I can pick them out really easily. But until then, what he was telling me didn't mean a lot to me, you know, because I had not yet experienced it at that particular point. So the frost situation is an important one that you need to be aware of when you're out there. The same thing holds true if you're out backpacking and you're going to go camping. Some of the camping sites down in the valley, you may find to be very cold because you've got cold air draining down and concentrating there at night. And you actually will probably be much warmer on the side slope, partway up the hillside, because there's a thermal belt, what they call a thermal belt, where temperatures are warmer, where the air does not concentrate in cold. As it is there. So let's take a few minutes break. Let me get a drink of water. And I'm going to take you at this point into a handout here and into some notes on plant succession. Zigzag. I was at mine was on Barlow. Yeah, which is east of there. Yeah.
My grandfather was the earliest settler that wrote things in the
Oh, really?
Huh.
Yeah, I know where Welch is. Yeah. I'll be darned. That's amazing.
And then in Okanagan, we had Forest Service people.
That part was scientific.
The wives.
Yeah.
Rex Loisio was the supervisor up there.
I didn't know him. Yeah, I went there. Gary Nelson was supervisor. And he left. And Bill McLaughlin was supervisor for many, many years, just retired as well.
Yes. We were there earlier. And of course, the Forest Service people were always the close friends of
us. Yeah.
We're not used to that jerk.
Yeah, most of those people I don't know. Some of them.
That's right.
Yeah, I went there in 1975. And you left there before? No. Yeah. 1963, I was packing my bags and went to Samoan Islands. Two and a half years. Yeah. That was a neat experience. One never to be forgotten.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Are you familiar with those drills down in New Zealand?
Cowie trees, only just a little bit in the literature and everything, other than the fact that New Zealand and Australia, more than any other places in the world, is where I'd like to go.
These are tough trees.
Where is it?
That's why I forgot to mention, I brought in all the pillows I could find.
Yeah, I see.
The only other chairs, we have a few of those folding chairs and those dining room chairs, and that's it. These are left over from the miners, you know, trying to use them to death, but they are uncomfortable after the first hour.
They were almost exterminated by the sailors.
I'll be done.
That's amazing.
Yeah, unfortunately, we tend to exterminate almost anything that's of value to us.
I thought you were going to go into clear
cutting. Yeah, we'll just go down there. Yeah. Took them to pasture.
Great.
Yeah, I went through the passes right in. Yeah.
I never did talk about it. It looks a little bit like that.
Well, he's always in the office talking to surveyors, and they asked him to grab dark lines. So I knew who he was, but I never did visit with him.
Well, let's get started. You got a question?
The name of the book yesterday, I got the one on the one on the volcano.
Okay, I'll go get them. I meant to bring them there. For those of you who find these seats uncomfortable, I think we all do. I got as many pillows as I could find, and there's a few left on the back chairs there. So sometimes you get them behind your back or something. They're helpful, but these are not the most comfortable chairs.
I brought down the two books that I was talking about yesterday, and let's have those passed around just as I flap my gums here, and you can take a glance at them and write down a reference if you want.
And,
sure. Did everybody get a handout? There's plenty more. I brought 50, so everybody can have one. Anyone else need one? We are going to go through that handout in some detail, and that's just simply a small amount of the information that is available if you actually start getting into things. My particular specialty as an ecologist is synecology, and that's the study of plant communities. Or actually, odd ecology deals with the studies of individuals and their relationship to their environment. Synecology is more involved with community things, and vegetation grows together in particular patterns, and we call those plant communities. And that's my particular area of expertise, or at least area that I'm most interested in and spend most of my time. To be an ecologist, though, in that sense, you've got to know at least a little bit about a lot of things, because you're pulling together a whole bunch of stuff and trying to see what relates to it. And one of the definitions I heard about higher education is everybody knows what a BS is. It's more of the same, and a PhD is piled higher and deeper, is the definition that I heard. Also, as a person goes on through university experience, you start to learn more and more about less and less until you know everything about nothing. And
what's most climbers say about
it? So you have this kind of thing. So let me give you just a little blurb here. I have an introduction that I'm writing for a guide for the Wenatchee National Forest, Forested Plant Communities, about plant community classification, some of the concepts, and some of the things that we do. And I'm going to be reading some of this to you, so it's going to be just as boring as it can possibly be. But it covers it in fewer words than I can if I just stand up here and talk. So various cover type and site classifications have been found inadequate to answer many questions being asked by resource managers today. And management of natural resources and range and forested lands has become increasingly critical as a result of greater resource needs and increased public awareness. Nowhere is this more evident than the management of public lands. Hall states that the management of non-arable lands, forest and range lands, is primarily concerned with deriving products from the natural vegetation, and as resource management intensifies, knowledge about vegetation must increase.
When I talk to Forest Service managers, I ask them what they are, and usually they'll tell me they're land managers. And I say, what do you get from the land? And they almost always talk about vegetation characteristics. I find it appalling that a large percentage of them don't even know the trees on their forest or their districts, much less the other vegetation, because they have been so oriented towards, society has driven them towards commodity production, and Forest Service is undergoing a tremendous flux right now with changes. And the opinions that I express are my own. They are not those necessarily of the agency. The agency probably would not want me expressing my opinions because they're not necessarily the party line.
You're not beating around the bush when you say that, are you?
Well, I just want you to know that this is not an official Forest Service statement that you're going to be getting in this particular thing. But plant community classification actually deals with taking a potentially infinite number of stands that we visited and take data on into a relatively few classes, groups or types, so that we can more easily comprehend them. And within that concept, individual of types should be more similar to each other than they are to members of other classes. And we traditionally, as people, classify things because we cannot deal with everything as an individual entity. Our minds are simply incapable of doing that. Now, we separate between male and female, and if we write some taxonomic characteristics where we could separate male and female, we would put things like males are generally hairier, depends on your age, and a few things like that, which applies pretty well to the entire broad spectrum, but you can find almost all forms of intergradation in between, and so it is with plant communities. There will be some things that are very clearly separated from others and others that are quite transitional. But we develop these kind of pigeonholes in which information applicable to all members of a type can be placed. And that's really what I view as a major contribution of the work that I do. If I go to a group of foresters and I say, I was in a stand of Douglas fir, when I say that, what is your mental image? If you're primarily accustomed to being on the west slopes of the Cascades, you will have one mental image of a stand of Douglas fir. If you're from the northern Rocky Mountains, you'll have a very different image of a stand of Douglas fir. And so will the foresters. But if I go to them and I say I was in a Douglas fir pine grass habitat type, and those people that are familiar with that vegetation classification, they know exactly what kind of stand of Douglas fir I am talking about and its characteristics. And therefore, we can communicate. Because if I'm talking about management of Douglas fir, it's very different from one place to the other. But if I can specify that it's this particular plant community or habitat type, then they know where we're at. And so when they manage that particular piece of ground and they try a technique and they find that it works successfully for what they're trying to do, they can say, on Douglas fir pine grass, we did this and we got this result which was desirable to us. Or we did this and it was a failure. You know, it did not work. We could not get the trees to grow on there again. Therefore, on all Douglas fir pine grass habitat types, we should not do this and we should look at doing this. And that's really my major tool as far as communicating with other people. That's a way of identifying sites and communicating what is in those sites, in those pigeonholes, and proportioning out the environment. However, the development of classes involves an abstraction from reality. We go out and sample a forest stand, and that's a real entity. But by the time I put it into an abstract conceptual thing like a Douglas fir pine grass, that is an abstraction. And it's put together for particular management implications and purposes inherent in that. So it's a conceptual thing. And so as your purposes of classification may change, you may end up with a different type of classification depending on what sort of criteria you apply to the stands that you're looking at, the individual plots. You know, for some people, species are not very important. Structure is, sizes of the things and structure. For wildlife biologists, that's generally more important than is the species of the trees present. You know, they want to know whether it's got multiple layers and so forth. I want to know whether Douglas fir can reproduce successfully on the site and things like that as a plant community ecologist. And so we approach things in a somewhat different way. But plant communities present after a relatively long period of time, free of disturbance and with stable composition, have manifested their ability to exist under competition under time. These communities are termed plant associations, and represent the climax of the plant community. This is, again, an abstraction because most of our stands never live long enough as an entity to reach climax because so many of our successional or seral species, as we call them, are very long-lived, and we have disturbance comes too frequently. You know, if you've got a 1,000-year-old tree, a tree that can live 1,000 years, such as Douglas fir, and it's growing on a site capable of supporting silver fir will outcompete Douglas fir on the same site over time because it is more shade tolerant and more competitive. However, silver fir is far less tolerant of disturbance than is Douglas fir. In the 1,000-year life cycle of that mature Douglas fir, you've probably had 3 or 4 major disturbances that have come in on that site and may have knocked the silver fir back. And so it's not very often you'll get into a pure silver fir stand, you know, that is only silver fir, kind of a thing. But this conceptual endpoint of the plant association or climax plant community is very useful because it tells us the direction that that vegetation is moving. If I have a stand, as I tell foresters, that I've got grand fir mixed with it, and I've got Douglas fir and ponderosa pine and Yoverstroy, and logging people have traditionally gone in and gone after the ponderosa pine and the Douglas fir because those are commercially very valuable species. Those are both relatively intolerant and unable to compete in shaded conditions as compared to grand fir. But if you've got grand fir in that stand, if you go in and take out the good overstory Douglas fir and ponderosa pine or western larch, you rapidly change that site to a pure grand fir site, which the foresters, as far as loggers go, don't like at all because the wood is of low value, it's highly susceptible to disease and rot and other things like that. And they say, we're having site conversion. I say, you're not having site conversion, you're doing a type conversion from one timber type to another. You're going from the seral species to the climax species and accelerating that change by introducing a selective kind of disturbance that accelerates that change. And by knowing that those sites that will support grand fir and will go to grand fir under that treatment from those sites that will not support grand fir and will not go that direction is an important criteria for foresters to know, or to know what sites will are capable of growing Douglas fir if you go out and plant it. Or ponderosa pine.
I was wondering now, if they were to be permitted to log in one of these areas that isn't Douglas fir, then they were going to replant it with Douglas fir?
They very frequently have done that. Traditionally what they did, if it was east of the Cascades, they planted ponderosa pine on it. If it was west of the Cascades, they planted Douglas fir on it. It didn't always work because there was too much site variation. And then there's also genetic variation within Douglas fir that's quite extensive too. They've gotten a lot more sophisticated, but they, if you take Douglas fir, which is not very frost tolerant, and you have clear cut an area and made a frost pocket, and you may have had Douglas fir on there before, but when you clear cut it and made a frost pocket, you go out and plant Douglas fir on it, you will have guaranteed failure. And if you can identify that site before your treatment, say, hey, if I cut it in this pattern, or I've got a high chance of getting a frost pocket, therefore I must treat it differently, use a different harvest system, or do something different, or plant a different species, you know, and anticipate that ahead of time, then you don't have the plantation failures and things like that.
What about the soil itself? Does that affect?
Profoundly. And I'm opposed to the use of very much heavy equipment on most of our soils, particularly where we have the ash. Remember yesterday we talked about the loess, how it is angular and will stand in vertical cut banks. Mm-hmm. Our ash developed soils are very angular, glass fragments literally is what they are. If you get on those when they're wet with heavy equipment and the vibration of heavy equipment, that stuff compacts down and will become very hard and impenetrable. Though if you pick it up when it's dry, it's just like flour. But yeah, I've seen it compacted. I've got a photograph of a friend of mine, Trigvi Kulp, who weighs 240 pounds. He's 6'4", one of the Kulps. You probably know his father. Standing on the edge of what's called a tile spade that soil science uses. It's a long shovel with a blade on about that long and about that wide. He's balanced up on the top of that shovel, all 240 pounds, concentrated on that, and it won't go down. There are no rocks in that particular soil. It is ash, deep ash soil, but it's been compacted from repeated logging entries. That tells you a lot as far as a tree being able to grow out there.
What won't go down?
The shovel will not penetrate the ground. Somebody that size and that mass, he is a big man, you know. And there's a lot of weight on that point of that shovel.
Are weed trees?
Your beginning description of them as weed trees is indicative of a particular mindset. They are finding now, alder has been viewed as a weed tree, and they have, with diligence, tried to do everything they possibly could to get rid of alder on most of the west slope sites, that it may be essential to the long-term productivity of those sites, and they're finding now that mixed alder and Douglas fir stands are more productive than our pure Douglas fir stands, because alder is a nitrogen-fixing species, and fixes nitrogen in soil and brings its own built-in fertilizer. There's also considerable problems with the development of root rot over time. And they're finding now that perhaps a rotation of alder on that site is essential to get rid of laminated root rot. And they may have to use alder in there. But this is a transition that is coming hard to people that have grown up with the idea that these are weed species and they look at them as competitive. Everything out there has its role. When I first started sampling on the Wenatchee National Forest, there's a considerable amount of land down around Blewett Pass that's been selectively logged in the past, where they went in and took out the larch, the Douglas fir, and the ponderosa pine on those sites, and all they left was diseased and poor quality tolerant species such as grand fir. And when they got done, it's called take the best and leave the rest, sort of a thing, which traditionally we've done because you could make money on it, you know. The Forest Service definition of commercial forest land is land that we can reforest in 5 years. The timber industry's definition of commercial forest land is, can I afford to log it and get the trees off? And therein is a profound difference in approach, you know, in the way that they look at things. And I've gone out with industry people, yeah, he says, this is commercial land. I said, but you'll never grow trees back there, but that's irrelevant. Because they can immediately get the product off. And their time span is a very short-term time span, whereas the Forest Service is kind of caught in the middle between the environmentalists, who have a very long time span perspective, and industry, who have a very short-term time perspective. And the Forest Service caught in the middle. When they got 16 appeals to the Okanagan National Forest Plan, I told the planning staff officer, I said, well, I said, that means one of two things. This means either your plan is terrible and it stinks on all sides, or actually you did a pretty darn good job of balancing everything out, and now everybody's mad at you, which is really what a compromise is about. And that's where they're at right at this point, I think. So we use these concepts of climax and plant community to help give us more information on the landscape, to give us a better direction how we can manage these particular lands and what they are best adapted to and what will happen if. I like to use the thing, what if, you know. If we do this, what can we reasonably expect? And you have to understand vegetation and vegetation dynamics in order to do that. So that's basically a lot of where we're at. To get into plant succession, and here we're going to start going by your handout that I gave you. Simple definition of plant succession is a replacement of a species or a community by another. Generally, it is somewhat orderly and predictable for a specific area. However, it can and does vary according to a multitude of factors, including soils, climate, vegetation, stand condition, type and magnitude of disturbance, history of use, etc. For the majority of our work in the Forest Service, we deal with what is known as secondary succession. We're dealing with lands that formerly had vegetation on them, and it's coming back. And this biological legacy of previous vegetation on the site has shown to have very profound implications, and Mount St. Helens has brought this into very close focus. The first couple of years after the eruption in the blast zone, it was a moonscape, you know, just gray ash over everything. But they found out that the biological legacies of buried plants, buried seeds in the soil, old logs and rotting logs and organic material and everything like that had a tremendous influence on what sort of vegetation immediately developed from it. It was not like starting from scratch. You started from a base of something. You had this legacy that was coming forward, even in that moonscape sort of appearance. And it profoundly affected the revegetation. And it's going taking place much more rapidly than they anticipated, because, in part, because of the biological legacies.
Didn't the horse tail pop up like almost immediately?
Yeah, things like that started popping up. And they found all kinds of things that they never realized would respond in the way that they did, in part because of this. So that has a really a big influence, you know, on what happened. How intense the disturbance was, how long-lasting, the timing of the disturbance, and things like this are also very important. Case in point, over many areas in the Pacific Northwest and the northern Rocky Mountains, Snowbrush ceanothus is considered to be a weed species, a very shrubby, very aggressive species that crowds out other plants. It also is a nitrogen fixer. It has very long-lived seeds that are hard, and they live in the soil, and those seeds have a couple of requirements in order for them to germinate. They may live in the soil for at least up to 400 years, they think, at this point. Ceanothus. Ceanothus vellutinus. We'll see it at the buckbrush. We can see it out here. The reason they say that is they have gone into stands that are 400 years old, and there's absolutely no sign of ceanothus on those sites, and then they've harvested them and burned them, and they get a very dense stand of ceanothus that comes up. And there's no way that it seeds in. It's not a seed that is blown on the wind. They're very small, like a BB kind of a seed. And so they're not easy. So that's another name for it, snowbrush, buckbrush, varnish leaf, ceanothus, all kinds of names. That species is viewed as a major problem. It has two odd ecological requirements for that seed to germinate. One, it requires a scarification of the seed coat. It has what's called a hard seed coat. In other words, it has to be either mechanically disturbed or be chemically disturbed to break the dormancy layer that is inherent in that seed coat. Additionally, that seed needs cold, wet stratification. In other words, it needs to overwinter where it is soaked and it's cold, so it's not growing, but this is so that the chemistry, internal chemistry of the seed gets going, and then it will germinate in the spring. The traditional way that many of these sites have been treated is they have been clear cut and they have broadcast burned in the fall. And in the following year, they get tremendous response of ceanothus. If you broadcast burn those sites in the spring, most of the time you do not get the cold, wet stratification that the seeds need in order to germinate, and the amount of shrub cover afterwards is generally much less on a spring burn than it is on a fall burn, if you're dealing with ceanothus that resprouts from seed. But if you're dealing with an existing stand of ceanothus that already has it, it will resprout from its root crown. And spring burns protect the root crown because the soil is wet and the heat of the fire does not go down into the soil very far. So you've got to understand your species. You've got to understand your site conditions that you're dealing with. You know, what have I got there? What are the characteristics of my species? And then if you view it as a problem, you have to design your management to accommodate that particular thing. Traditionally, the mindset of foresters has been clear cut and burn in order to reduce shrub competition. Studies now over a large number of years in the northern Rocky Mountains find out that most of that, if it's burned in the fall, you get more shrubs after the burning than you do before. Our solution is, in part, the contribution to our problem. Now, that's a generality, and it varies from site to site. And you have to be aware of what is on those particular sites and look at those specific things and treat it accordingly. No, I don't. But seeds are one of the more fascinating things. Seed physiology is just absolutely fascinating and complex. Some seeds are dormant for many, many years. A lot of the desert plants are dormant for many, many years until there's enough precipitation. A little bit won't do. It's got to be enough, you know, so there's enough for that plant to complete its life cycle. And the timing and everything is really remarkable. When I was a kid growing up, my folks lived next to a vacant lot. And my dad was raised on a farm, and that was not his profession, but he viewed weeds with an undying hatred. And he thought sons were born in order to weed. And so he used to send me out in the vacant lot next door when I was a teenager to pull all the weeds. Well, that was an incredible task, which I hated with a purple passion. He often said that I watered more weeds crying about it than I ever did. working on it. But if my dad would have understood anything at all about weed physiology and adaptation, he'd have realized that he was actually encouraging more weeds than he was discouraging by his treatments. Have you ever noticed that? That as you weed your garden, they seem to go and go and go. One of the adaptations of many weed species is they require some disturbance and a flash of light. Now, when you go through and hoe your garden, what do you do? But only a certain proportion of the seed bank that's in that soil will respond under a given disturbance and flash of light. So, Zappo, you hoe them out one time, and then it seems like overnight you've got another batch, so you go back and do it again, and you wonder why you got another batch the next time. I think green asphalt's a real good solution. I have a black thumb when it comes to things like that.
Yellowstone Park does with vegetation.
Yeah, that's, we're going to talk a little bit more about fire ecology. That's a good introduction to that. So, with this here on plant succession, there's a couple other things that I want to talk about on your list. So these lists are approximate. I've got these ranked. These are trees. The first table there is called shade tolerance, and the class is high. And then you've got a common name in the middle, a scientific name on the right, and the species code, the one that I use in the computer programs all the time, is the second column over. And the class is high, but in that list of major species here in the Pacific Northwest, and this is by no means exhaustive, they are ranked, as best we understand, in order. In other words, Western hemlock is believed by most physiologists to be somewhat more competitive and shade tolerant than is silver fir. But as you go up in the mountains, shade tolerance is not the only factor that's important. Tolerance to snow loads, to temperatures, and everything else is important as well. So it varies from site to site which one of these is actually going to be the best able to reproduce itself. But within that ranking of shade tolerance, you can see it. So some species that we look at in closed forest stands, we say we're never going to be climax species because, unless in unusual circumstances, because they're simply unable to replace themselves under the relatively shady conditions of a closed forest canopy. Lodgepole pine is one of those. The larches are one of those that are very intolerant of shade. They're opportunistic and they grow very rapidly given a disturbance. Now, lodgepole pine, because the situation came up in Yellowstone and is well worth discussing right now, has a very interesting fire adaptation. It is made to burn every couple of hundred years. And in fact, is if you want to maintain lodgepole pine on a site, you need to do that because it cannot replace itself unless you're dealing with very specialized soils. West Yellowstone, Montana, black obsidian sands are so inhospitable to trees that virtually no other tree can grow there, so lodgepole pine grows there. And much of central Oregon on the pumice from Mount Mazama is so inhospitable that only lodgepole pine can grow there because it has the widest ecologic amplitude to frost and low nutrient conditions of any of our other species. So on those specialized soils, lodgepole is climax simply because no other species can make it on those sites. But if other species can grow with lodgepole pine, they will eventually outcompete it. Now, lodgepole is not designed to survive an individual fire. The individual tree is not designed to survive a given fire. I have a friend of mine who works in central Oregon, and I told him we were up on the Caldwell. He was doing a tour looking at some of the studies we'd been doing up there. I said, I'm going to show you some fire-scarred lodgepole pine. And he laughed at it. He's a great big loud guy, and he just laughed. He says, never happened. I took him out and showed him three fire scars on lodgepole pine. They were still alive. Very unusual circumstance because it normally does not survive fire. It's got thin bark, easily damaged. It's killed very easily. And so it's designed to die, but its seeds and cones as a population are designed to survive, and that's what happens in Yellowstone. You have cones on those trees that are many, many years old. The seeds are in a closed cone, and not all cones on a lodgepole are this way, and it varies from population to population. But these cones are closed, and they have to get temperatures above a certain amount before the cones open and the seeds are released. And so the fire does that, and it rejuvenates the lodgepole stands. a lodgepole pine is relatively short-lived. It's unusual to get a 300-year-old lodgepole pine. So if you want to maintain a lodgepole pine forest, you need a major fire through there every 200 years, or some sort of treatment adapted to the ecology of that particular species if you want to maintain it. Now, some of the forests over there, they're doing a very enlightened way of doing it. They'll go in and they'll harvest it, they'll leave the tops and everything and the cones underground, and they'll watch it until there has been temperatures of a certain amount above a certain level, you know, for that time. Then they'll open the area up to woodcutters and then come in and get the rest of the wood, because the seeds have come out of the cones that are laying on the ground. They're now in the soil. They remove the excess fuel through firewood cutting at very little expense, you know, to the Forest Service. The people in town are happy because they're getting free firewood, you know, very easily. And they have a very sophisticated program on the Targhee National Forest using firewood cutters, but they understand the physiology of the tree, how to regenerate it, and how to get it done. They're doing it very cost effectively. I was very impressed with some of the things that they've done. Now, other species have an entirely different fire adaptation. Ponderosa pine, Douglas fir, and western larch, as they become mature trees, develop very thick and corky bark that insulates them from fire. Western larch in particular has a very open, airy crown that does not concentrate heat. And so western larch is our most fire tolerant species. And if you go on over to the next page. Yeah, that's right. It is a blow.
What's that?
And on this second table, fire tolerance of mature trees, and you go down, it says PICO, lodgepole pine. The scientific name should be Contorta, C-O-N-T-O-R-T-A. Pinus ponderosa is ponderosa pine. Yeah. There's lots of things like that. I make mistakes all my life. Depends on who you talk to.
It used to be used like this wood here.
Yeah. It is. It's a lot more marketable than many industry people would tell you.
But it does grow profusely in some areas.
Oh, yeah.
And get very large.
Right. Because it grows on such poor sites.
I'm a little confused by the terms high, moderate, and low under the class.
Yeah.
So what does it mean? High. Class.
Well, that is, in a sense, it's. Its shade tolerance is quite high compared to other species. Yeah, this one here is fire tolerance, and there's two rankings there. This is fire tolerance here. And so larch, which if you look at the first table, is rated as very low shade tolerance. Western larch is rated very low on shade. It's classed as low. It's the very highest as far as fire. And its adaptation to fire is very thick insulating bark on mature trees, very open airy crown that is not resinous. The needles on larch are not resinous as they are on the pines. And so it does not have a flammable crown. It is also deciduous. It is adapted physiologically to annual replacement of its needles. The other conifers are not. And so if you take the needles off, it has an extremely difficult time replacing them because they're replaced over a period of years, a few at a time. And so western larch, with a major fire that comes in the fall of the year, which is characteristic of our environment because we have the summer drought and things dry out and then you get lightning storms that come through, and that's traditionally the way that these species adapted, the western larch will survive that fire if nothing else will. Now, they can be killed by an intense enough fire, but they will survive while many other trees underneath them, other trees that are less tolerant of fire, will die. And then they will seed in, being opportunistic, they grow very rapidly in height because they are intolerant of being shaded by other species. And you'll go through and you'll see a stand of western larch much higher than the other trees underneath. And the other trees underneath are more shade tolerant and competitive. And given time, they'll replace the western larch on the site. Now the larch is praying for another fire every so many years. And as an individual, it says, I will survive. Because I have thick, corky bark and I don't burn, I will survive. And it's larch's adaptation is as an individual to survive. Lodgepole pine's adaptation is an individual, it will die. One's communist and the other one's a capitalist, you know? lodgepole pine always views for the good of the state, I will sacrifice myself. That's what communism has always asked for. But my population will go on. Western larch is much more of a callous as I, as an individual, will survive and hang the rest, you know, kind of a thing. And that's sort of the way that they survive. And you can go through these lists, and I don't have time right now to discuss every one of them in detail. But it kind of gives you a ranking. There's other factors that are important in plant succession, but we understand them less well. And one is resistant to diseases, and this varies by species. Another is resistant to mechanical damage, which might include snow loads and things like that. Frost, some are much more frost tolerant than others. Annual heat and water budgets, and chemical warfare of other plants, allelopathy. Now, ponderosa pine, one of its problems in regenerating itself is, one, is it's fairly intolerant of shade, and two, it is inhibited by materials leached from its own litter. Seedlings are weakened by that, and so it has a difficult time regenerating. Now, if you go out into the ponderosa pine forest, look how dense the grass is and other things are underneath the ponderosa pines immediately around them. It's not wholly due to shade, you know, because a lot of them don't throw that much shade. But the vegetation will be very sparse underneath. And it's because of leachates from the needles and the bark and that inhibits the germination and growth of other species. Engelmann spruce is that way, and here we find that Engelmann spruce really inhibits lodgepole pine, but does not inhibit subalpine fir very much. So traditionally we've gone out and looked at these stands and says, subalpine fir is more shade tolerant because it's regenerated in these dense Engelmann spruce stands more so than anything else. May not be shade tolerance at all, it may be tolerance of allelopathy. So it becomes very complex and interwoven, and we by no means have all of the answers yet. All this indicates that the forest community we see is extremely complex and interrelated. Linkages between and among communities and species are greater and more complex than we ever imagined. In reality, we know and understand very little of the complex biology of a forest stand. It's only in our ignorance that we think we know what's going on. That's why I'm not very popular in the Forest Service. Now, the rest of that handout is some plant identification notes for trees. And that's not going to cover every tree we're going to see tomorrow, but that will cover the majority of them. So tomorrow, as we meet, let's plan on going for a walk, so bring jackets or something, because it's going to be 9 o'clock in the morning. We're not going to go any further than what Ruth took you on the other day on your nature hike. Did you go down to the falls?
Yes.
Okay. We probably won't even go that far because we're going to stop and talk along the way. I'm going to bring along an inclement borer. I'm going to core some trees and age them. And we're going to talk about stand dynamics as related to there. And be aware that this valley has burned out catastrophically and very intensely, probably in the last 100 or 200 years. I don't remember the exact dates that I figured out last year. And it will happen again. And the fact that we are here makes it even more likely. And so you need to be aware that when you're out there, Mother Nature is kind of like, I read an article the other day on computers. Computers are mean. They always act the same, whether you're there or not. You know, if you make a mistake, it will never read it right. You give the wrong file name to it, it's a file not found, you know, kind of thing. Mother Nature is entirely uncaring about you when you're out there in the woods. And if you're in the way when something's going on that she's got operating, that's just tough. Don't expect it to be benign or easygoing. She is indifferent to your presence, by and large. And she will do her thing eventually, whether you want to or not. Yellowstone is a classic example. We did everything we could as a nation to stop it, and Mother said, hey, you've been knocking down little fires for years. The lodgepole either dies from a fire or dies from a beetle attack. In Yellowstone, they had the beetle attack several years before. You had a tremendous amount of fuel buildup. You have a high lightning-prone environment. You had high winds. And no one but God could have stopped that thing from burning when it got going.
And people.
You had sources of ignition. And when she wants to go, it will go. There is nothing we can do about it if a fire really wants to burn. So we need to recognize that. It's like when the volcanoes go. When they want to blow, they're going to blow. There ain't anything you can do about it. They used to think many years ago that they could stop hurricanes. What they won't tell you is that they put an A-bomb in the middle of a hurricane back in the 50s. They thought, this will blow it up. And it was headed safely out into the Atlantic. It changed course and hit the coast and was quite destructive. You never hear them talking about that anymore. And they don't want to mention that because the liabilities on that are absolutely astronomical. We cannot, in our arrogance as people, expect to control Mother Nature. The world was organized on principles by God far beyond our limited understanding. Now we can mess with it and screw it up. And if you get into the scriptures, you'll find in the last days that the earth will be covered with smoke. And it'll be destroyed by fire. And if you really get into the stuff, it sounds an awful lot like a nuclear war, you know, of the last days. And it's very frightening. But the message of the Bible is that God will preserve those who are oriented towards Him. And if you study the scriptures, you find an awful lot of ecology in there. You find an awful lot of direction about the way the world was. We talked about in the days of Peleg, the land was divided. Geologists never would read the Bible. That didn't make good sense to them. But there's wisdom and knowledge in the scriptures that are as yet still hidden to us. We are unwilling as yet to accept or understand. We're talking about tremendously powerful processes that are operating and have operated and will continue to operate. We either need to align ourselves with those and work with them, or try to spit in the wind is really what it's going to amount to. It's like trying to stop the fires in Yellowstone. I have a friend of mine, he just retired, very experienced firefighter, had fought all over, and he says, I saw fire behavior, he says, that I never believed would have existed in Yellowstone. And that was a man with about 30 years experience of fighting fire all over the western United States. And when she goes, she'll go. This valley will go one day. When I came up here last year, I was frightened at the fire potential for here and the way the village was and the way things were going. And I called the ranger and they said, yeah, we're working on it. We're going to try and do things. I think it's an unwarranted assumption on the part of the community to think that God will protect them because this is a Christian retreat. We've seen over the time that God helps them, they help themselves, so to speak. So it can be, the hazards can be reduced.
That's what you had said last May about the state of the woods here, and the fire yet to come. We were here in September for a week, I believe it was.
It is an area of concern, and the village is very right in being very careful about it. They need to understand the forest dynamics around them a little better and have a larger buffer. And they should have metal roofs on the houses and things like that. Rather than anybody that goes out and builds in a forest and puts a shake roof on their house needs to have their head examined. Make it metal or tile. And people say, well, gee, they look nice. Right, they burn great. You know, and anytime you're in a forest, that forest will burn. It has in the past. It does not matter what forest it is, and it will, particularly in the Pacific Northwest. The ones on the west side burn less frequently. But when they do go, it's devil take the hindmost. Most of the Olympic Peninsula burned off at one time in one major fire event. The Blue Mountains of Oregon were named for what? You know why? Because they were covered with smoke all the time from the fires. So there's a lot that goes on there. Okay, tomorrow we'll get ready to take a hike in the woods.